A very warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time. In these episodes, we are discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guest, I should mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom. So if you do hear a few noises, please understand, and I'm sure you will. Anyway, you'll know why. Right, so helping us in our explorations today is Kevin Borda. He is head of the National Inventory, Research and Archaeology Unit within the Superintendence of Cultural Heritage. Welcome, and thank you, Kevin, for accepting to come on the program to talk to us about developer-funded archaeology, what that entails, and the significance of this method within the field of archaeology. So, before plunging into that main theme of our conversation today, perhaps we need to place the Superintendence of Cultural Heritage in a bit of context for those who might not be familiar with the SCH. Perhaps you could give us an outline of the functions.
Yes, first of all, good morning to you, Patricia, and thank you for having me on your program. Thank you on behalf of also of the superintendents for giving us this opportunity sort of to communicate more with the people and yes, to raise the awareness of what the superintendent stands for. The Superintendence of Cultural Heritage basically is a government agency, and it is tasked with the protection, preservation and promotion of all cultural heritage on the island. In fact, we function in terms of the Cultural Heritage Act, which replaced the Antiquities Act way back in 2001, with the latest update of the Act being, in fact, quite recent in 2021. So, again, if we look at the Act, we can, you know, see the task, the mammoth task that we have, because it defines what cultural heritage is. Cultural heritage is not simply archaeology. I know that the program is, you know, archaeology, going back in time, etc. But, you know, the Cultural Heritage Act includes works of arts, buildings, landscapes, monuments. It even specifies that anything which is older than 50 years can be considered as cultural heritage. So that gives you an idea that even though we have quite a small territory in Malta, which is densely developed, has been densely developed and redeveloped over, you know, millennia at this stage, and this has given us a rich cultural heritage aspect and group of items, which yes, one can consider as assets. So as I said, the superintendent's main role is to safeguard the cultural heritage. It must ensure that every act which happens on the island, which might affect somehow or other one of the various aspects of cultural heritage, is monitored, is regulated, is directed to not create any impact or minimize such impacts. Most people most probably will be familiar with the superintendence in view of its engagement with the planning authority. But there are two important acts in Malta which regulate this aspect. One is the Cultural Heritage Act and the other is the Planning Act. Both require that the superintendence is consulted on development. So during the processing of a planning application, the superintendence interacts, advises, gives direction on anything which would affect standing structures or else unknown archaeological sites or even unknown. Therefore, there is the monitoring of development sites. We also monitor restoration works and buildings and even artifacts. The superintendence also is involved in movables. For example, few people would know that anybody who is moving out of the country and he's taking all of his belongings must submit a declaration that he is not taking any work of art belonging to Maltese cultural heritage with him. Again, when people import or export works of art, they need to register such works of art with the Superintendence of Cultural Heritage. And then the superintendence has also a very important role in agreeing to giving consent and permits for research investigations. I mean, not anybody who wants to come to Malta or being even a local will be automatically given a permission to excavate an archaeological site. Archaeological sites are finite. Whenever we tap into or excavate a particular feature, we have to assess, for example, how many such features do we have which haven't yet been excavated? Because we must always leave a resource for future generations of archaeologists, basically. So, you know, this is in brief what the superintendent does.
Fair enough, yes. In brief, of course, sure. Because you have an enormous remit, which I think perhaps people really don't underestimate it. You are head of this unit that I've mentioned, the National Inventory Research and Archaeology Unit. I gather it's a fairly new unit. Perhaps you could briefly just explain your role within it.
Yes. Well, basically, we've had to start from scratch, sort of the superintendence of cultural heritage. You know, we'll be celebrating sort of 20 years in the making, since it was first set up after, you know, the Museums Department was disbanded and Superintendents of Cultural Heritage and Heritage Malta were set up as agencies to replace it. In the initial phases, recruitment within the superintendence was rather at a low, starting, I think, with something like 5 officers, gradually increasing, and lately we have gone up to 45 officers in all working within the superintendence. This, of course, permits to address all the different functions which the superintendents should be doing, always in line with the Act. So yes, that's so the creation of various units within the superintendents to make sure that these tasks are being addressed. Yes, within my unit, as we said, there are various aspects which are being tackled. One of the most important is the setting up of an inventory. I mean, the inventory of cultural heritage is stipulated in the Act. This was already started in the very beginning by in the superintendence, and now we're continuing to build onto it. The inventory, as it stands currently, deals mostly with immovable assets. So basically we're saying, you know, buildings, archaeological sites, etc. But it must also include the movable heritage, of which we have, you know, thousands of items. So this must include the National Collection, which is sort of housed in the main museums and managed by Heritage Malta, but it also must include artifacts which are stored in our repository. It must also include all those artifacts belonging to private museums, but which have been made available to the public, as well as church property. Apart from that, also, my unit is also responsible for proposing scheduling of property. Scheduling of property is governed by the Planning Act, and it provides legal protection to buildings, basically, and archaeological sites. Until recently, all the process was being managed by the Planning Authority, but since 2019, the superintendent has taken over its role. Again, within the Cultural Heritage Act, there is a specific article which states that the superintendents may comment for scheduling any property or site that deems worthy of protection, and we are building on that. So now the superintendents is the agency, is the authority which decides which property merits scheduling and processes a request to the Planning Authority. Then it will be the Executive Council at the Planning Authority who agrees or otherwise for its scheduling. Apart from that, also the unit manages our archives, our repository. The superintendent has an interesting archive made up of administration files. These go back to 1934. So, you know, it's almost, you know, 100 years of files. And there you will find a variety and wealth of information going, you know, from simply issues with ticket sales, the requirement of one of the custodians to have a rain jacket, to the actual discoveries, the loan of artifacts to foreign institutions in the past, restoration interventions, archaeological discoveries, participation in international fora, you know, so it's a whole narrative. And if you read it in conjunction with the museum annual reports, I mean, there is so much scope for study there. So, you know, again, one of the tasks of my unit is also research, and research is not simply doing research, but promoting research and making data available to students, scholars, researchers, you know, the whole lot. And also we have also a repository. In our repository we have, you know, excavated material from the last 30 years, at least. And there again, that's another important resource which we are in fact making available to undergraduate and postgraduate students to have access to new material and not keep utilizing secondary sources. And finally, one main task which we will be sort of expanding so much more on today is monitoring of archaeological sites. This is the famous development funded or development led aspect of archaeology, where the superintendence is active, issues terms of reference, licenses private monitors to make sure that in those developments where there's the high potential of making an archaeological discovery and there's an archaeologist at hand to record, document, and safeguard.
Yes, just listening to you is sort of, I can see that it's just a huge endeavor, really.
Yes.
So, yes, this is a good segue into the main subject of our discussion today, and that's developer-funded archaeology. Perhaps very briefly, you could generally say what it is and in Malta exactly how it functions.
Yes. So, I mean, as the name implies, you know, there are three main aspects working here. We have development, we have some type of funds, and we have archaeology. As you well know, Patricia, usually if you're going to start on an archaeological excavation, you don't just decide one fine morning to investigate that site because, you know, I'm interested in it. There should be solid and valid research questions which need to be addressed. When we come to development-led archaeology here, the need is specifically to inform the planning process. So in a way, that is the research question. Is there archaeology on site or not? Can the development be permitted or not? So the process starts off from the consultation phase. When a planning application is submitted, the planning authority is consulted, the superintendent is consulted. So there, in our consultation reply, which is the official position of the superintendent vis-à-vis the development, monitoring may be requested. And monitoring is governed by terms of reference. We issue terms of reference. So the developer, through private funds, needs to employ an archaeologist so that the archaeologist is present on site during all the phases of development, that the appropriate documentation is carried out, that the, you know, everything is up to standard, etc. So that's mainly what the development-funded archaeology is. So the aim is to identify any archaeological remains, understand what they are, record them, and from there, we need to come up with sufficient mitigation measures. Mitigation measures is, you know, how are we going to preserve this archaeological find if there is one? Do we need to leave it exposed because it's unique? Is it one of known other examples which can so be buried, and the access is limited sort of to the owner, or by appointment, or simply by through the documentation which would have been carried out? I mean, well, you know, that's sort of the gist of it, really.
That's great. You were mentioning before sort of how archaeology happens in Malta, and I think that perhaps this is of interest to see how the archaeology develops within the Maltese territory. As you say, normally it's sort of like academic pushed, or it's pushed in a different way. This is a new way of doing archaeology, if you like.
Yes, it's completely a new way because, again, looking at the academic aspect, usually you're going to investigate a site because it is representative of others which were excavated, for example, in the late 19th century or early 20th. When you have, when at the time you had, you know, different techniques, different reasons for excavation. So it is essential now sometimes to go back to 100-year-old excavations, try to re-excavate, try to identify any surviving stratigraphy, to understand the site. And so, for example, that is something which Heritage Malta, which manages Malta's publicly accessible archaeological sites, is currently doing in most of its sites, sort of it's reassessing what was done 100 or plus years ago. Whereas there might be a newly discovered archaeological site. For example, imagine if we had to find a new prehistoric temple, which was never recorded before. The need to excavate it would be sort of quite obvious or partly excavated to fill in lacunae, which we don't have, because when they were excavating them 100 plus years ago, they didn't do that type of recording. But then, at the same time, if there is a new Roman tomb, so there might not be the need to excavate it. So yes, as we've said, when it comes to development funded, Malta is a densely populated island. There's no doubt to that. And the density is increasing. We have specific development zones, and these mostly overlap with all the areas where we know that there is archaeology. Because at the end of the day, if we had to leaf through the museum annual reports of the last 100 years, why was this archaeology discovered in most cases? Because there was a development. I mean, what's happening now is no different than from what was happening, in the interwar, post-war period. Again, even up till now, we need major infrastructure works, whether it is new facilities, community facilities, such as hospitals, old people's homes, better roads, new roads, resurfacing of existing roads. And surprisingly, all of these are turning up more archaeology. Now, if you look at an archaeology hotspot like Rabat, Rabat is a living community. People sort of die, move out, move in. So there's this constant need to develop and redevelop. And notwithstanding, we keep finding new and exciting discoveries. So this is all development-led, because there is a developer who's developing his own site, be it a large apartment complex or a small townhouse, which can still lead to a minor or major discovery.
Yes, there are some of these sort of advantages, if I'm going to put it in inverted commas, if you don't mind.
Yes.
Possible discovery of new threads of interest in areas previously, as you said, not undiscovered. But there is the caveat there that ultimately these developments will be destructive elements within the archaeological record. So what happens when you actually find something within a development that's going on? What are the decisions that SCH takes, and what can they take, really, in this regard?
Okay, let's start from stating the obvious that, the Maltese territory is divided between ODZ, we hear a lot of ODZ in the news, and the development zone. The development zone were sort of last decided in, 1988, if I'm not wrong, with the final revision in 2006 with the rationalization scheme. Any change to that boundary would need to go to Parliament. So we are presented with an actual state of fact where if we mention the archaeological hotspots in Malta, let's say mention Rabat, Mdina, Zabih, Mjar, Shara in Gozo. These are where we have even the UNESCO World Heritage Sites in most of them, and these fall within development zone. So there, yes, you cannot not permit development, because then there's the whole issue of acquired rights, assumed rights, property rights. It's a whole civil...
It's a complex thing.
Yes, complex of civil law.
We spend a long time discussing this. Unfortunately, we just don't have the time.
Yes. No, so basically, when we discover archaeological features, well, first of all, in whatever the archaeological feature is, we need to document. Then we decide whether we need to investigate fully or partially. And we can look at different case scenarios. For example, surprisingly, we're finding a lot, but, in the thousands of agricultural trenches. Previously, they were in literature referred to as vine trenches. However, lately we're using the term agricultural trench because they were not necessarily used for vines. As we say, we find thousands of them. So here, the superintendents might decide to record by documentation only, basically document and destroy. The important thing is that you have proper documentation, stratigraphy, environmental samples if needed. So there's the full academic requirement of how to deal with an archaeological site. Then you might find more complex sites. For example, in Malta, we still find a lot of tombs. Just to give you an example, in December, we were excavating a late Phoenician tomb in Rabat, and this was discovered when a 1970s terraced house, you know, run of the mill 1970s, was demolished under monitoring, obviously being within Rabat area, and as part of the monitoring process, this tomb was identified. It was sealed completely intact. So, and the development had already sort of not had the basement approved during the planning process because we engaged in the planning process. But then we were faced with a decision: what to do? Should we leave it sealed there or not? And we decided that this being a sealed tomb, and it would be more suitable to open and, you know, extract all that there was. In fact, we found two full skeletal remains and a full assemblage of a late Phoenician early Punic tomb. So now the fact that we had the opportunity to go in, scientifically investigate and document, always with, you know, private funds, now we have added information to re-understand all those tombs, which sort of there is only a fleeting mention in the museum and the reports, for example. You know, so that provides us a possibility to reassess what has done. Now the way forward is that the tomb is going to be fully retained, you know, incorporated into the development. It will not be accessible in terms of how we understand. People cannot just go and look at this tomb. But we even created a 3D model of this tomb, you know, so yes, it may not be the same thing, but at the same time, we need to reach out as many people as possible. So even people who might have mobility problems now can access, you know, this tomb virtually. Then you might have more important features discovered where the development has come to be completely altered. For example, development might have had a basement approved, because the area wasn't known to be so archaeologically sensitive, but then you discover an important site. I can mention that, you know, in the southern part of Malta, in the Marsaslog Bay area, there was this large undeveloped site. The known archaeological sites were within, I don't know, 150 meters distance, so you don't really assume that to be archaeologically sensitive, but having been undeveloped, the superintendents directed an evaluation, because intervention within the development-led sphere is not limited to monitoring. The superintendents can, during the processing of an application, halt the application and carry out an evaluation. And we usually do this in sites which are undeveloped, so that whatever is found then can be better preserved, better incorporated, etc. And in this particular case, we found the remains of a rustic Roman establishment, which was clearly processing oil. We found two anchor blocks, you know, part of the machinery to press oil. And here we have the developer who is completely on board with the project. He's going to incorporate this project. He's going to create a small visitor center. University of Malta archaeology students had the opportunity to spend last summer school, because all the archaeology students are required to excavate during summer, and they excavated there. So we're collaborating with academics from the University of Malta, and this all has stemmed on from an accidental discovery through a development-led archaeological experience, basically.
Yeah, that's a very positive example.
Yes, I mean, of course, I mean,
that's the case.
I'm not going to lie, and there are the worst case scenarios where architects or developers do not collaborate, where yes, we have to consider the complete reburial of the archaeological site or feature that has been discovered. But again, the important thing that here I need to bring across is the documentation. We always ensure that
was going to be my sort of next question, really, the importance of the quality of the archaeological record and accessibility to it at the end of the day.
Yes. So we ensure that there is full scientific documentation of all that is discovered. When we are not right of a discovery, of course. As I said, there's a recovery of all the pottery, artifacts, even environmental samples at time. There are plans, section drawings, surveys carried out, 3D scans where possible, you know, so there's the full documentation available. This sort of, you can see it as a raw data. Then it is stored in our archives. Accessibility, we are improving on accessibility. I think at the moment, we have in the last 2 years, we had something like 8 students doing undergraduate or postgraduate in archaeology who have accessed our archives. So they're having direct access to the actual material, the actual documentation for them to present as part of dissertations.
So people or professionals, professional archaeologists or recommended students can actually apply to you, to
the superintendents,
and ask to have access to these reports?
Yes, basically they write to us. Ideally, if they're going to do an undergraduate or even postgraduate dissertation, they would have already made contact with the academic entity who's going to sort of provide them with the tuition and ideally the supervisor as well. And then yes, they write to us, we hold meetings. I mean, at the moment, for example, as we speak, we're in contact with 2 students currently studying undergraduate archaeology at University of Malta, and they're going to have access to 2 sites which have never been published, but we have all documentation which was development funded, and they're going to provide and to prepare a dissertation on the subjects.
Well, we've come almost to the end. Okay. A very quick question, and if you can, sort of quick answer. Very often, when things are put on social media, there's cries of, oh, why doesn't SCH stop the works? Or why didn't SCH veto this decision before it was granted? What would your quick answer be to that?
My quick answer would simply be that, you know, we can't. In the sense that, as I mentioned before, I mean, the Maltese Constitution, for example, establishes that each and every one of us must protect cultural heritage. This again is reiterated by the planning, by the superintendent, by the Cultural Heritage Act. The Planning Act, you know, has a provision for scheduling property, but then at the end of the day, it also has issues permits for demolishing buildings and excavating sites. As we speak, the superintendent does not yet have a right of veto. So if a permit is issued for an excavation of a basement in Rabat or next to the Hypogeum, we cannot simply stop it. We can suspend it. We have the authority to suspend it, and more often than not, we do suspend until we go in, we investigate, we document, and we give a direction. I mean, if we had to permanently freeze these development sites, that would mean that an owner has had his property rights breached. So what do you do? You ask government
to... It's a thorny question, which you're... Yes. I mean, I don't think we're going to sort of...
No, because the only solution... Yes, the only solution would be for, you know, government to simply buy each and every site or where the development has been found, where the archaeological feature has been found, you know, and it's quite hefty. But, you know, but in conclusion, if we look at 2021, for example, there have been a total of 143 discoveries. You know, archaeological discoveries, some important, some less important. We're finding quite good collaboration from most of the developers and architects. As we've already mentioned, you know, this is creating data which is being made accessible to academics, to students. Eventually, the inventory of the superintendents, we're going to shift it to a GIS-based platform. You know, people are more familiar with maps, you know, online maps. With the different, we can mention Google Maps, which is sort of that application which everybody uses for everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now we're going to even start presenting cultural heritage on a similar platform. Through that, there will be access to basic data, possibility to even the 3D models, you know. So I think we should look at development of archaeology as an opportunity rather than as a threat. If you had to quantify the amount of money which is spent by the private sector in archaeology per year, it runs into the millions. And these are millions which simply the superintendents out of this budget does not have. So we are the more richer with the information which is being provided if the government-led archaeology was not present at all.
Thank you so much, Kevin Borda, from the Superintendents of Cultural Heritage, for coming to talk to us about this very, very interesting, very topical subject. Thank you so much. And I hope that our listeners will join me again next week when we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
And thank you once again.